Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jimmy Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. Up first this hour, the last days of Big Law. And that's not my title for this segment. That's the title of the cover story in the current issue of The New Republic. And it's created quite a firestorm both inside and outside legal circles. The author is my next guest, Noam Shiver. He is senior editor at The New Republic. Noam, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the obvious question. What is Big Law?
Big law, depending on how you classify it, is the largest, most profitable 100, 200, 250, say, law firms in the country. Their clients are typically Fortune 500 companies, companies that make, billions of dollars in revenues each year. And they do the legal work. They advise on the mergers and acquisitions. When these companies are sued for, say, product liability, or when an executive is accused of securities fraud, they tend to go to Big Law, and Big Law defends them.
So you're talking nationwide, New York, nationwide, but also yeah. Chicago, California, even D.C., et cetera.
Exactly. I mean, not surprisingly, I would say New York has a very high proportion of the firms, that we consider Big Law. But, these are really national, even global law firms. So even firms that are not based in New York all typically have very large New York offices.
And you report that there are currently between 150 and 200 firms in the U.S. that can claim membership in what you call the club known as Big Law. We may be losing Noam. Noam, are you near a big cell phone?
Did I go out?
You went out a little bit. Now, in the interest, I'm going to take some phone calls from people, not only because I don't want you to drop out and I'm talking to myself, which nobody wants, but also because I'm guessing that there are a lot of lawyers who are listening who either worked at big law firms or currently do so. In the interest of full disclosure, I worked at one of those places, Morrison & Foerster, when I was starting out in my career before my journalism days, the biggest law firm in California at the time and still one of the top 10 in the country. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are big lawyers or even paralegals or other staff at these big law firms. So if you are, please call 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Have we seen the end of days for what Noam Shiver is calling Big Law? Or you can post a comment at WNYC.org, click on the Brian Lehrer Show, Will the Big Firms Rebound? 212-433-9692. Noam Shiver is my guest. We're talking about big law firms. Noam, in the old days, and by the old days, I mean roughly 1800 through the 1980s, big law meant what besides the definition you gave? Are we talking cushy offices, partnership? What else did it mean?
Yeah, I mean, I riff about this a bit in the piece, but, in addition to the actual legal work itself, it meant stability, it meant cushiness. By the time you made partner at a big law firm, it was basically punched. Layoffs were pretty rare. Obviously, there were periodic recessions. In recessions, I mean, even if you look at the worst recession of all, the Great Depression, a lot of the big law firms, and many of which still exist to this day, they did okay. And then during the recession, during the Depression even, they did a lot of restructuring work, bankruptcy work. And so they were kind of, they did well on the way up and they did well on the way down. It was a very stable coexistence.
And is stable a word we can use today to describe the legal profession?
Yeah, absolutely.
You think stable is a word? I don't think I read your article. I think you said that stable is the last word you would use to describe today's legal.
Sorry. Yeah. No. Stability is not an adjective that I associate with these days. It really has become quite a kind of rat race. The bottom line is just a kind of fundamental problem. There is way more capacity, way more high-priced legal talent than work to go around. And, you know, this is I sort of got into this with lawyers who responded to my piece. You know, this is not the newest thing. This is really since the early 90s we've seen this begin to be a problem. The only reason why it's really becoming acute now is that we had two big bubbles that kind of put off the fate of big law. One was obviously the dot-com boom of the late 1990s, and the other was the real estate bubble of the 2000s. And so even though big law has been kind of, you know, dealing with some really fundamental problems over the last 20 years, they were hidden from view by these big bubbles. And as the bubbles suddenly were left, this kind of structural mismatch between the amount of work there is and the number of lawyers there are.
All right. What I'm going to do, Noam, is I'm going to take a call from Robert, who's in Rego Park. We're going to call you back, Noam, on another line and continue our conversation about big law with Noam Scheiber, senior editor at the New Republic. So thank you, Noam, for your cooperation on this. And Robert, Rego Park, Queens, you are on WNYC. Thank you for your call.
Yes, how are you today? My specific question is this. Does this gentleman feel that big law is basically a lobbyist for the private companies, that they're so connected, this big law, to federal government, states, that the biggest companies in the world are turned to them simply just to not contribute to society and to get out of their problems in the easiest way?
All right, Robert, I do think Noam could hear the call. Noam, were you able to hear Robert's call while we switched your line?
Yeah, I think I got most of it. If you might want to just briefly restate the question.
He wants to know if they've essentially become lobbyists. And I guess ultimately is that part of what's led to their demise?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's certainly an element of what they do. You know, outside of New York, after World War II, say, you know, probably the biggest growth industry or locale for big law was in Washington. And, you know, a fair amount of what the big lawyers do in Washington is, you know, intercede on behalf of clients with government, with federal agencies. So it's certainly an element of it, but it's, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's probably, you know, it's a minority of what they do. It's still really, the big money is still made, I think, you know, advising companies on mergers and acquisitions and defending executives, you know, against kind of, you know, very serious lawsuits, you know, defending them against, you know, the SEC, say, when they're accused of securities fraud, you know, that sort of thing. So it's certainly been a growth lobbying, and kind of whether formal or informal, has certainly been an element of big law that's grown up, you know, really since the mid part of the 20th century. But it's by no means the be-all and end-all of what big lawyers do.
No, it always seemed to me that these firms, at least some of them, were just too big to fail, if you'll pardon that expression. but clearly you don't think so.
Yeah, no, I don't think that. They're very clearly not too big to fail, because we've seen some very big failures, some of the biggest law firms in the world over the last few years. So that is self-evidently not the case.
So is it the recession? Is it the outsourcing of tasks to contract attorneys? Is it because the clients just started to ask questions about the expenses or the hourly fees? I mean, what's happened to the big firms?
That's right. Yeah, it's all of those. I mean, at the heart of it, there was just a certain irrationality, you know, in the model, which was, you know, you could charge you could charge corporate clients much more than they actually needed to pay if this were a competitive system. You know, if they would solicit multiple bids and really get a look at what they were being charged, they could have done this a long time ago. The reason they didn't in most cases was really twofold. One, there just wasn't a lot of transparency in the billing for law firms. They just didn't get a look at entirely what they were being charged for. And two, it represented a pretty small share of the budget. You know, for if you're a Fortune 500 company and you're used to dealing in hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, you know, the difference between spending $50 million or $75 million a year on your legal services isn't that great. But what's happened over the recent decades is, they are getting a better look at what it is they're paying for, because there's now sort of all sorts of sophisticated software that they use that really does all the vetting of the bills for them, so it doesn't require, you know, forensic accountants to sift through it. So now that they can see this, they become, you know, sort of aggrieved that these firms are charging them all sorts of inflated fees. So that's certainly going on. And then, as you say, there are now alternatives in ways that there just never were. There are legal outsourcing firms, they call them legal process outsourcers, where you can hire these armies of contract attorneys for a third, you know, or a half of what, going to a big law firm and relying on them will cost you. So there are these alternatives, and there's this transparency, and neither of those existed 20 years ago.
You talk about the great Gordon Gekko word greed, but I guess in your assessment, greed has not been good for big law.
No, I mean, it's been good for some individual lawyers. There have been these rainmakers, and they have, you know, as lawyers have become kind of superstars, kind of free agents. There's a sort of, Alex Rodriguez mentality in the legal profession where you can just kind of keep jumping from firm to firm and continue to increase your salary that way. So for the top 1% or the top 10%, it's been very good. The problem is, you know, because the pie isn't really growing, it's sort of a zero-sum game, and you increasingly have these this kind of these sort of plebes, who are partners but are getting squeezed in a variety of directions because they don't have the same rainmaking ability. And it's just led to all sorts of resentments, as you can imagine.
Well, and speaking of plebes, you write that it's almost impossible to overstate the trauma of the recession on the associates who have lived through it. And associates are, of course, the younger lawyers who work for the partners in a firm. Say a word about those poor souls.
Yeah, you know, the associates are the ultimate plebes. I mean, basically, in good times, the firms will pay an associate, you know, $200,000, $300,000 a year and then bill them out, you know, for $600,000 a year. So it's a real profit play for the firm. The problem is, in bad times, they become completely expendable. And you just saw just rivers of blood flowing, you know, to if you'll pardon the vivid metaphor. They were just these mass layoffs, you know, at the firm that I wrote about, Mayer Brown, which is a Chicago-based firm but with a big New York presence. There were at least three rounds of formal layoffs and then a variety of sort of informal layoffs where, you know, there were just sort of suspiciously timed upticks of bad performance reviews for lawyers. And they were by no means unique. I mean, really up and down that list of 200 firms that we've talked about, you know, well more than half have these engaged in these mass layoffs. And, you know, when I would talk to people at these firms, they would just tell you about the trauma of this experience where, you know, you would have people making $200,000 a year and they were living, you know, on month-to-month, you know, rental agreements because they never knew when the axe was going to fall. I spoke with one woman who had worked at the firm for 10 years. She was making, $230,000 in 2010 when she was laid off. You know, she's now making $40,000 a year, so almost a $200,000 a year pay cut because, you know, when everyone is laying off lawyers, there are no jobs if you happen to lose yours. So
yeah.
It was really an incredibly
grand market.
And her story,
the story you tell, that woman's story, and you write about it in great detail, is really moving. I want to compel people to read that the whole article. But when you get down to her story, it really brings the entire human element to the fore. I want to take a call, if we can, Noam, from Andrew in Chelsea, who has a recollection. Andrew, you're on WMYC. Thank you for calling.
Hey, how are you? I can tell you exactly what I think is going on, guys. Your rainmakers are finding better deals elsewhere. My ex-husband, who is a partner at Heller Ehrman White McAuliffe, that went belly up. And if you'd like to talk about it, it's probably my ex-husband saying, how dare you? But that's okay. He still owes me $200,000 in alimony, which I have not decided to go after him for. So, honey, if you're listening, that's okay.
You need a lawyer.
Well, he's now still practicing law, but finally nonprofit, which is what I thought he should always do. But I don't think Hella Ehrman needed to bring all of our partners to the Ritz-Carlton. I don't think they should. I think they should have settled their $400,000 FedEx bill in San Francisco. I think that they should still pay back all the back rent that they owe at 333 Bush. I mean, it is unbelievable what these people used to do. And my husband and I let him be in charge of all of our finances, which is fine, and I trusted him. But when we got divorced, honey, let me tell you, $300,000 in credit card debt, and I had no clue. I was not a happy camper.
Well, so I remember Heller.
Some of the expenses that I think that these people incur is because they hire these. It's like you're almost hiring an entire army of staff to take care of a case. And, I mean, thank God he had Philip Morris under his wing as one of those people he could work for. And that's what got him his partnership at the firm. But he had other big, you know, companies that he would represent head outside counsel. But I think a lot of these law firms did realize that as the economy started tanking, who can we point the finger at first as far as cutting our budgets? And law firms went first.
Yes. And of course, Heller being one of the big law firms, San Francisco law firms with Morrison and Forster, the one I work for. Yes. Thank you, Andrew.
I personally didn't like how Heller earned it. I don't think people should have gone to work and turned on the terminals and said we're closed.
Andrew, thank you very much for your call. And Noam, you've talked about the massive layoffs that happened at the big firms and some of them, of course, going belly up. And the lifestyles we all lived back in those days were quite something. We should have looked forward to see that we couldn't continue. And the staffs we put on those cases, I have to say, they were mammoth. Yeah. But I want to pick up on one small thing that Andrew said. This is one small slice of the legal community that also includes public interest lawyers, legal academicians, personal injury attorneys, human rights lawyers, civil rights lawyers, list goes on. There are many ways to practice law, and the big law model is just one, right?
That's absolutely the case, and I certainly don't mean to suggest the contrary. The one thing that I think is important to keep in mind, though, is that, you know, I think lawyers at big law firms represent something like 15% of the legal profession. I could be off a few percentage points in either direction.
I think that's right in my research for this segment.
But they, you know, they do exercise outsized influence. I mean, you know, if you just take legal education, one reason that it costs, you know, $200,000 over 3 years is because of the salary that you can make at a big firm. That really drives the price of legal education. You know, if you look at law professors at universities, I couldn't tell you the exact average, but typically at a big prominent law school, you know, the average salary is something on the order of $250,000 a year, $300,000 a year. For the top ones, the reason they make that money is because of the amount of money that their students can make at big law firms when they leave. So even though we're only talking about a small slice of the profession, it is very influential, in driving the economics of the entire profession.
Yes, and I think what has happened to many of the big law firms and your piece as well, and the legal profession in general, is causing law students to rethink how they will spend their professional lives. And perhaps that's not such a bad thing, right, Noam?
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think of this a bit, and there's actually a book by a former lawyer, now a Northwestern professor named Stephen Harper, called The Legal Bubble. I do think of it as having been a bubble, you know, and both in the kind of narrow economic sense that the prices and the salaries were just way out of whack with fundamentals, but also in a sort of broader sense in that, you know, we just sent too many young people, you know, to this one sector of the economy. We deployed too much human capital to it. We spent too much of people's educations, you know, focused on it. And that wasn't really good for society, I think. I think, you know, we'd probably been better off if some of those people had gone into, you know, biomedical engineering or civil engineering or other aspects of the economy. There was just too much mind share and too many resources thrown at this one part of the economy.
Well, I'm a big advocate for law school, but I do agree in diversifying our intellectual resources as well. And I really appreciate your piece, Noam. And I want people to know that they can read your piece as well as a response piece that you wrote and the comments. So there's been a lot of generated commentary, and that's a good thing too, right, Noam? And I want to thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
My guest has been Noam Scheiber. He's a senior editor at The New Republic. To read the current piece on the last days of Big Law, you can visit our website at WNYC.org. Click on The Brian Lehrer Show, and once you get there, there'll be links to all of the other good stuff related to this topic. I'm Jimmy Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. Up next, the great urban exodus led to suburban sprawl. But what happens next? We'll find out.